Welcome to Heal and Go Public with Karen Hibner. Picture this. I sit in a large, open, airy, almost breezy warehouse on one of those little gray artist stools at a massive work table. You crack the door open, I turn with a welcoming and knowing smile on my face. I gently but joyfully wave for you to come in, and there's a stool set up for you. I ask you, what do you want to create or recreate today? I've built this studio to be a judgment-free space, a space that you can expand and expand and expand in, a space where you can surprise yourself with what you can build. We are all continually creating ourselves, who we are and how we are. I believe our own creative process is the door to our healing. I believe sharing our creations is often the access point to healing for others. I believe in healing and going public. I'm your creative guide, Karen Hibner. I'm an artist, podcast producer and editor, and former spiritual director. Let's explore what it means to create. Let's wonder at what it means to heal and go public. Thanks everybody for being here for another episode of Heal and Go Public. I so appreciate you being in this space. It is so fun to have you. And if you are in the space and you've been impacted by one of the dialogues that we've had here, go ahead and rate and review this podcast so that others can find it as well. That increases our searchability and our visibility and also helps others receive what you have received from this space or other things. So go ahead and do that for me if you'll take a minute. I appreciate it. I have an amazing guest with us today. We met in a networking space and we've become fast friends. We can talk forever on so many different topics and we're just continually finding more and more of these like overlaps and interests and things that we could just dive into as far as our research and our own personal wondering and inquiries. This person is an inquirer, I would say, like very interested in very many things, has also lived so much life experience and is also very creative and wears a lot of different hats in different ways. And so we'll see how she shows up today and what she's interested most in today. But my guest today is L.L. Kirshner. L.L. Kirshner is an award-winning screenwriter and author of two memoirs, including the forthcoming Blissful Thinking, a memoir of overcoming the wellness revolution. And actually, it's out, so get on your tablets and find this book now. A book critic, essayist, and reporter, Kirshner was once simultaneously the religion editor for an LGBTQIA plus paper, dating columnist for an alt news weekly, and bridal editor for a society rag. Her writing has appeared in Shondaland, The Rumpus, and The Washington Post, among numerous others. She runs the monthly storytelling show, True Stories. My goodness, LL, that bio is profound. Thank you for being here with us today.
You didn't even get to the HSN part.
She is a TV host, y'all. So welcome, LL. I know y'all can't see her face, but she looks TV ready today. She looks amazing. Thanks for being here, LL. Is there anything else you'd want to add to your bio today? Like who are you and how are you showing up today?
Well, whew, Karen, thank you so much. I don't feel TV ready today. I feel podcast ready and ready yes. to talk to you about all the wonderful. I mean, you're right. We talk so much. It was hard to even get started today because we were chatting.
Oh my goodness. We could just talk forever. I feel like, and like in our last conversation, we got into like our interests in cult things right now, leadership in the world, what it looks like for leaders to then have a platform, what becomes a cult, all of those things. So you are a journalist among all of the other things that you do, but can you just give us a little bit of like, I described you as an inquirer. I described you as a creative. What are some of these general more like, would you call yourself an artist? Would you call yourself a creative? How do you show up? Like, to all these different
funny.
Projects.
I feel like people say, oh gosh, creative. They don't like that. I've heard people say they don't like that moniker. I'm like, I think that's a great moniker because what am I? A Renaissance woman? I guess that would be the other thing. I don't like the sound of that. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I do have a lot of different interests. And I mean, I wouldn't even say I was a Renaissance woman because then I feel like I'd have to have, you know, some more serious math skills than I do. But, you know, I can find my way around the internet and stuff like that.
I am first and foremost a writer. I mean, if that was how I was going to identify. And it feels like everything else springs from there. And this is my second book. And of course, the reason I'm so fascinated by cults is because the healing journey that I went on for this blissful thinking story, I encountered a lot of different cults. And I came to see how so much of our lives are shaped by all things cultish, right? So, I mean, a lot of times in cults, we think of people wearing very similar clothing, similar haircuts, and like marching to the beat of a drummer who's going to take them off into their, you know, poison Kool-Aid death, right? But, you know, cults can be very different things from that. They can be like the level of your Orange Theory class, where you're all saying, you know, you're talking about your splats and you're talking about, you know, doing your reps and your whatever. And, or even recovery itself, which I'm a member of that cult. But if you sit around and listen to people in recovery talking, you'll think you're in a cult. I remember when I first got there, I was all of 19 and I was like, is this a cult? Because also the people looked very touched because they kind of had this happy glow about them. But now I kind of appreciate that. I'm like, if it makes you happy, you know, as long as you're not hurting other people. Although there is a cult in my neighborhood I'm not so crazy about, called the Bruderhofers, and they all dress similarly. And the women, it looks like they're not maybe allowed to cut their hair. The guys can dress like normal, but the women have to wear like, seriously, Little House in the Prairie, like long skirts, apron kind of things.
Fascinating.
In a very kind of blue, light blue beige colorscape. Like there's, I don't think I've ever seen other colors. Like I feel like these colors would just not go over. If you can't see them wearing like a green sweater and a lime green sweater. I'm double sweatering.
And you're double green, but different greens. And it works. It's great. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a little bit tangential, but this is very like on par for like our broader dialogue for today. So you say you predominantly identify as a writer. Why we're here today and why we've met is because of your book, Blissful Thinking, that's come out. And it's funny, when we initially met, I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what we would talk about, because like, Ella, like you are approaching things from like, okay, scientifically, what does this look like? Like not going down the like super woo-woo path of just like, what do you need? Does it work? Like kind of thing. But more of the space of like almost the skeptic that you maybe are because of journalism. And then like, but then like piecing it out, like, oh, how does it work and what works for you? And like all of those pieces, right? I mean, as far as what you brought up with recovery too, but
right.
I remember something that you and I chatted about. So I was listening to a podcast the other day and it was talking about manifestation and hitting rock bottom, like the part of manifestation where you hit rock bottom. And they said that often the people living the most interesting and coveted lives that they have see in their life have hit rock bottom a number of times. And this podcast made me think of you because when we talked last time, you were like, I did not set out, like you've written two books in the memoir category. You did not intend to be a memoir writer necessarily.
No.
You also just straight up told me, you were like, I'm done with memoir. I need to, you know, like I am tired of living, and tell me if none of this is public, if you don't want this public, but like, I'm tired of living a memoir worthy life.
No, I actually wrote that on my Facebook page the other day.
I love it. So it's public. Okay, very cool. So tell me a little bit about that process. I mean, you've lived a memoir-worthy life.
One of the things I love about your podcast, this idea of heal and go public. I mean, it's got a double meaning, right? Because you want to have your business go public, perhaps, and you are taking your healing to a public space. And that's kind of what I do with True Stories. It's what I've done with these books. And it's not that I don't love memoir, although I do believe it is the most difficult form to write because you are beholden. I mean, the way that I appreciate it is you're beholden to the truth. I'm not a big fan of the sort of fabulous memoir. The reason that I like memoir is because I like to see how other people have coped with their trials and tribulations in life. So, I mean, for me, in a sense, a memoir, there's going to be trials and tribulations. That's what it tells me right off the bat. So to have two, it feels like, oof. Although, you know, there are certainly more fun memoirs
Like, I have a writing teacher, Sue Shapiro, who wrote a book, something like Five Men Who Broke My Heart, I think is what it was. And it's about going and sort of interviewing those men and talking to them about it. There are definitely topical ways to approach a memoir that aren't quite as deep. But these, for me, were very deep because they dealt with these larger societal issues mm-hmm. as seen through the lens of my personal experience. And they kind of became undeniable. Like, the first one was about living life in the Persian Gulf as an expat. It's called American Lady Creature, My Change in the Middle East. And I wanted to write a series of sort of witty essays of what it was like to live in a land where women would sort of walk through the mall, they're wrapped head to toe in black, looks like they're floating right past Victoria's Secret ads, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was just like, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance in that space.
Yeah.
And I wrote so much about what was happening there because I wanted to write this book of witty essays. And then the next thing I know, my husband gets on a plane and ends our marriage over the telephone. You know, he's in the States, I'm in Qatar, and I'm thinking, what? Neither one of us had loved living in Qatar, but I thought Qatar was the problem, not us. So it felt, you know, massive betrayal. And of course, he was gone 8 time zones away. We're not talking about it. So what could I do? I had to find some way to process it. And the first thing that I discovered when I lived in Qatar, and that's really what the first book is about, is all the ways I had internalized misogyny, because a theme in a lot of the essays that I was trying to write were about how they view women primarily as wives and mothers, and how, for lack of a better word, just how backward that was. Well, when this happened to me, I had also gone through early menopause. So early menopause, turning 40, husband leaves, boom. I fell into this deep depression and I was like, well, who's going to want to date me now? Mm. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. How is that any different from the way they are looking at it? Like, my deep belief is the same. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I came back to the States. And at that time, so this is a long time ago, you know, Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton, I mean, Hillary Clinton was running for president, Sarah Palin vice president, but in the media, it was all, here you are, bitch or bimbo, this is what you can be. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, we have not come a long way, babies. So I just couldn't let go of writing that book. Although this was before feminism was a word that we were allowed to say. We were still sort of riding the wave of derision for feminism. I don't know what wave that's called. You know, you've got second wave and third wave feminists, but what about the, you know, the feminist haters? What wave is that? Anyway, that was the wave we were on. And I really wanted to write a book about, like, reclaiming my feminism. And I would have had that somewhere in the title, except it's, no, you cannot put the F word on your book. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, they were all coming, because that came out in 2014, 2 years before Me Too, before feminism was a word that you could say. Like, mostly people were saying, like, well, I'm not a feminist, but, you know, I believe in equal pay. I don't think that women should be treated as sex objects. I think that women should have equal opportunity in the workforce. And it's like, where does the I'm not a feminist part come in? What are you not feminist there? Mm-hmm. Anyhow, so while that book was coming out, events of the next book were sort of taking place. And really what that was dealing with the prolonged grief of having lost my ability to have children, having lost my marriage in this really spectacular fashion, and compounded with grief over a loved, you know, my first boyfriend having died, but many years before that. But all of these things were roiling around in my mind because, as you mentioned, I'm in recovery. So I got sober when I was still in college. I was a teenager. And you might think, well, what did your parents send you to rehab? No, I took myself because I had had bleeding ulcer. I'd been institutionalized multiple times and I'd had jaundice. Like, I was a serious drinker. I don't know how much you know about recovery, but the book is sort of divided into stories. And at the beginning, you get the more gritty, hardcore stories. And the first meeting I went into, they read this story called AA Number 3, which is like super hardcore. I never related to anything so hard in my life.
Wow.
So I had gotten sober, but then when my boyfriend died, I relapsed. Yeah. And I was very worried in the wake of this divorce of that same outcome. Even though I had been sober again continuously at that point for some 10 years, I felt the same as I had before when I had relapsed. And at that point, I had had 7.5 years. So it's not like I had a year and I went out, or 2 years, or even 5. Like, that's a lot of time to be sober. And I feel like one of the things that gets very little attention in today's, you know, attention, like splintered reality, is how we deal with people in long-term recovery in the culture, in the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
So it seems like we have stories about people just at the depths of their despair. They're bottoming out. It's terrible, terrible, mm-hmm. terrible. And then bing, they're better. And then we're like, oh, well, they're fine now. And, or it's stories of people in early recovery. You see more of that, like in TV shows and things like mm-hmm. that, where there's a lot of chaos all the time. And you don't get as much of characters like just sort of living their life with long-term sobriety, because the fact is, it's like, it's no more okay for me to drink today than it was in May of 1996 when I had my last drink. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like, it doesn't make it, the time does not change the problem, and the thinking is a problem, and the thinking can continue to get screwed up on and on and on. And my title, Blissful Thinking, it's kind of a nod to Carrie Fisher's Wishful Drinking. Like it's sort of a nod to that, but also it's ironic because, as you know, I wanted to sort of meditate my way into bliss. And really, I found it through sexual agency, frankly. I found more release from trauma and pain through reclaiming sexual agency. And some of that, of course, that makes sense considering what had happened to set me off on this journey. But I wouldn't have had any idea. I was like, I'm just going to go meditate my way. I mean, I went to a sex cult thinking, I am not having sex here. Well, I did eventually. But like, that's how, you know, it's so easy to get so messed up. It's like my feet kind of were like, okay, I'm going to go here and I think it'll help. And then I get there and I'm like, bah! And you know, of course, the funny part is I get there and I'm like, okay, nobody better come on to me. And then nobody did. And I was like, what's wrong with me? That level of effort combined with that level of denial, that's pretty intense.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But like, that's what our brains do. And like the narratives that they're protecting so intensely. And like, even with Richard Swartz's IFS and like all of that, the different parts of us that are protecting different narratives, and like, it can just get so complex. Of course we can. I mean, the I contain multitudes piece, right? Like, of course I contradict myself. Like, we are multitudinous beings and integrated peoples that just are, we're so complex. So of course, as you're affronting kind of all of this, you're trying to process all of this misogyny and this culture that you've been living in and navigating all of your own personal like experiences and fallout with your main relationship and also the loss of another main relationship, like at the same time, you know, of course there's like these thoughts that are, so a big piece of what I used to do was I was a spiritual director for like 8 years. And we would talk about a big methodology that I would employ in this space was functional beliefs versus held beliefs. And it's amazing how something can come out of our mouth of what we believe in, but what we actually live out day to day can be a completely different, that's our functional space, right?
Yes.
Which illuminates that we actually believe something maybe different for ourselves than other people, or believe something different inside of us than we do, you know, like in our like idealistic, like values, beliefs, space, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, it's the battle between the neocortex and the amygdala, right? We have this thinking brain. But then this is where it's at, really, back in the amygdala. And frankly, that's pre-verbal. So is it any wonder that a lot of us turn to these alternative healing spaces like yoga or even like a CrossFit can be a way of trying to process trauma. And as we talked about the other day, the trauma, there's no support on the other end. You show up in these spaces for healing and they know how to teach you how to meditate or they know how to teach you how to do crow pose, but they don't know how to deal with your trauma. And it can just become, these healing spaces can really become sort of hotbeds of unwellness, shall we say.
Yes.
And you see this in these scandals that rock the yoga community. I've written about a couple of them, but I haven't in a while, even though they've continued to happen, because I just, they're so the same.
Yes. And this is something too. So my partner is a therapist, and we've talked a number of times as far as people coming into his space and being like they cannot kind of unify. They cannot interact with their emotions or some deeper processings that they're going through. They have not done a lot of trauma work, all of that, but they have found themselves in yoga and they'll be like, I just burst into tears in this certain pose every single time. Is that normal? And he's like, well, like, yes, because like you store all of this stuff in your body. And also we need to talk about it here. Like we need to process this in the therapy space. Also, like whatever's coming up, what do you feel like? And when people are like, I just randomly burst into tears. And it's like, okay, like, yes, I'm certain that it felt random. And also right. like maybe what was, you know, what was the body movement? What was the space of your body that was like opening up? Like mm-hmm. what, you know, and then what memories are held there? What, you know, like taking it to those levels. So I can totally see like there's the both sides of it too, right? As far as like you bring people in to be with their body, but then there's no support for like the deeper work, or we're in just the talk therapy space and there's not the processing of like on a somatic level also. So it's right. like, how do we navigate? How do we bridge this space? And I actually do know of one friend, she's an author and she's a yoga teacher, and she felt like she was doing these, she became a yoga teacher and started offering this in tandem with her workshops, because she was doing these workshops that dug up all of this like trauma stuff with people, and then felt like there was no place for them to go to like process. Actually process it, right? Mm-hmm. And so then she started incorporating body movement and yoga into the space as well. And I'm like, that's a beautiful example of like the tag team, right? But how did you navigate that as far as like going into this, like these yoga spaces, this like sex cult, like all of that space, without giving us too much of the book, of course, but how right. do you feel like you were able to kind of bridge that as far as the like body processing and the cognitive processing?
For me, it really was this sort of combination approach, and I just didn't let it go. So that's the other thing. I started going to therapy again when I was in New York. Like I had kind of veered over a little bit into yoga world, where it's like, yoga is all I need. I can remember a woman telling me that she was doing exactly what you're talking about. In fact, I met her around the pool in Mysore. I think it was around 2009. I was studying Ashtanga with Sri K. Patabi Joyce. And she was like, I asked her what she did, and she told me she was a yoga therapist. And I'm like, well, how's that? What is that? What do you mean by that? Yoga? Like, I was like, that sounds like the Department of Redundancy Department, lady. What are you talking about? That's like, luckily, you know, I had a good friend who was like, you need to go to therapy. And I was just like, ugh. But I did, because I recognized like these things were not coming together. And I have no idea. I don't think I became a skeptic because I went to journalism school. I think I went to journalism school because I was.
Yes. Yes.
You know, but that has, I honestly advocate that approach with a light touch. So like, I believe that there's a way to be skeptical in the world and not take in some of this information overload that we were talking about before without being completely subsumed by it. And some of it was really what came to me at the end of the journey, was instead of constantly focusing on what was wrong with me, because that's what I was trying to figure out. Like, what is so wrong with me that my husband could just leave me like that? Yeah. Right? What did I do? And the thing that I needed to sort of focus on instead. And this actually helped me dealing with feelings of anger that I had ongoing toward him, was looking for what was right. So ultimately, and I think it's because we have such a powerful storytelling brain, which is where a lot of these people come in, and they can make up stories that we'll believe just to have a story rather than to be operating in the void, right? But the stories that I started to look at with my ex, I couldn't start telling a story without it quickly embroidering and devolving, right?
Yeah.
So one of the techniques for dealing with someone that you have a resentment toward is to pray for them, right? But even trying to go there, my brain would kick in. So I just had to do it through visualization. And the visualization was to see him happy, to see people that I felt had wronged me in some way happy. And that was a game changer, a massive game changer.
That's incredible.
This show is brought to you by my podcast editing business. Do what you came here to do, which probably wasn't podcast editing. Sharing your particular magic by going public through podcasting helps others sink into their own special kind of magic. Then we all heal this world together. We need your voice. We need your story and what you have to offer this world. I work with coaches, activists, spiritual directors, therapists, authors, and all kinds of creatives to help them get their particular wonderful out to the world. Through podcasting, my clients are able to give freely some of their greatest offerings in order to grow their audience, land more clients, and nurture those clients. My clients' audiences get to know them, get to feel what it's like to work with them, and build an actual connection and relationship. Y'all, voices are amazing. By waiting on your files, I help keep you accountable to creating powerful content for your audience. I help you to continue nurture your audience and care for the people in your orbit. Also, let's be real, by creating this regular content, you're getting way more hands-on and keeping the pulse of your business and your audience. Side note, content that we can then repurpose for all your other platforms you feel like you have to be on. If you've been editing yourself, I save you massive amounts of time and allow you to speak freely. No more worrying or stressing while you're recording about having to go back and edit it or starting over or having to pause or having to stop and edit your thoughts while you're talking. By refining your recordings and beautifully packaging them, I help you deliver high quality, high value content to your audience and current and future clients that changes who and how they are, which changes the world. Schedule a free 1-hour discovery call with me today. I'll help you define your goals and intentions for your show, your greatest challenges, and your greatest wins in the space, and how to continue creating a show that is in perfect alignment with who and how you are. I also offer consult calls and podcast strategy packages. Get on my schedule for your free discovery call today at KarenHibner.com or through the link in the show notes. Now let's get back to it. I think as I'm on my own kind of, this is relative, I'm sure, and you'll get it. But as I'm on a lot of my own religious deconstruction journey, learning a lot about just how powerful, which is both, right? I mean, you can see it in religion also, but how powerful our own minds are, how powerful our thinking is. And that's, I even mentioned at the top, like this manifestation podcast that I was listening to, like playing with like, just like, what do people's experience with these things look like? And what is the science that's behind it? And what I hear you saying also is that back to like when you began answering was the skeptic word may even be too harsh. You're an inquirer. You ask a lot of questions. You discover, you explore. And really like from my spiritual direction practice, I would call it wondering. Wondering, okay, what's really happening here? What's really happening here? What's really happening here? How can I show up to this? And then I also hear too, your access point for moving forward for you was visualization, which is a tool, but visualizing these people in your life that had wronged you so deeply happy that they've moved, you know, they moved on, they're experiencing the life that they want and need, that you also may be free to do that as well too, whatever that unlocked for you, right?
Right. Well, by that time I had studied with a lot of different teachers. I had done energy work. I had been to these silent meditation ashrams. I'd done chanting. I had done mandala. Sound bath. I had done a lot of different types of meditation modalities. Because again, I still was thinking that was the access point. And it is. I mean, developing mindfulness habit is huge. But unfortunately, it's very easy for me as an anxiety person, right? I don't think of myself as particularly anxious, but I can quickly kind of go there. If that
get in frenzy.
Sense.
Yeah.
The predisposition that I have, which is basically this addictive personality, right? I can become consumed with something.
Yep.
I needed to really study a lot of things and feel like I had options because like you, I was told, I was raised a Catholic and this is the story and this is the God and this is how it is. And the God sees everything. He knows everything. And oh, by the way, he knows what you're thinking too. So, you know, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And I had to really look at how that carried over even into like spiritual, but not religious practices.
Because
I had become someone who believed that this insight meditation technique, which I learned at the beginning of the book, which I talk about at the beginning, was the true style. Because I had done all these other types before and never experienced any kind of profound change. But silent meditation, I did experience a profound shift in the way I viewed the world as a result of that experience. And I thought, well, this is the thing. This is it.
Yes.
but it was actually causing me to be more anxiety ridden.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and I'm not alone in that, but yes. At the time I didn't know it. Many years later, I came across a study that Brown University released in 2017 saying, oh, insight meditation can be anxiety inducing in people. And I was like, what? Because all you ever hear is meditation will bring you bliss. Yep. You will find your inner Buddha. This is how you find your inner Buddha. You know, find bliss, meditate and meditate. I've seen meditate and find happiness, meditate and find your success, meditate for love, meditate, like as if meditation can fix everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't, and it can exacerbate problems for people. Mm-hmm. Certain types Absolutely. Of meditation, right? Like this silent meditation.
Absolutely.
So I started looking into other types.
Super powerful for you to share your journey in that, because we're so kind of pushed in this direction, at least in culture right now. And in the last probably 10, 15 years, really pushed towards that meditation technique. Mindfulness is rampant in our culture right now, which is like really beautiful. There are really beautiful sides of it. And I've mentioned this a number of times in this space, but that also like there are things that are contraindicative to meditation. And I've heard a number of people in the recovery space also, because that's a big thing in the recovery space, at least from hearing. I do not have personal experience here, so you can correct me.
It's one of the steps.
Yes, that meditation is like really pushed in the process and that it is not accessible for most folks. And I know people that are in recovery that have felt that there is something wrong with them because they cannot access that tool in the process.
Because they hate meditation. But the thing is mm-hmm. I feel like that's because we have a very narrow definition of what meditation is.
Yes.
I
mean, sit by you yourself,
turn a walk
in quiet.
Into a meditation.
Yes.
And that for me was, again, the big game changer. And
yes.
I remember talking to Tara Brock, who's a spiritual teacher. I was interviewing her for an article. And I remember being so afraid to ask her about using different types of meditation when mm-hmm. silent meditation, because she teaches insight, like her thing is
yes.
meditation. And she was just, I mean, this is not a quote, but she was like, oh, of course, that's what you
of
do.
Of course.
Like, you know, her attitude. And I was like,
she's amazing. Yes.
I was,
relief.
Again, it's that idea in my head that I'm somehow doing it wrong. And even if I was, I'm just going to say this, love Tara Brock, but like, even if I was doing it wrong, according to Tara Brock, who cares?
Mm-hmm.
That's
who
her story.
Cares? Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes. I love
story.
It.
Now, I'm a
and
believer in reality. Don't mm-hmm. get me wrong. I am a believer in reality. But when it comes to opinions, mm-hmm. like her opinion about the ideal, optimal meditation, that's an opinion.
Yes.
Like, truly.
And what she has found that works for her and works for a number of people that she's worked with, a lot of people that she's worked with. And that doesn't mean it has to work for everybody. And that's where I hear too, that you have a similar religious background as far as where religiosity or scrupulosity can come in, as far as like, oh, I've been told that this is the way that it is, because that's what we're given in religious contexts. This is the one way. And if you don't, and I'll speak broadly here, I know that this is not your opinion that you're sharing, but this is the one way that it is. And if you do not fit within that, you're out. Right?
Right. Yes.
So like, you know, so it's when we are given that as a way that our, like when those are our neural pathways, it's so hard to get away from that and break away from that, which
right,
is funny.
If you're outside the tribe, you're as good as dead. Right?
Yes. Our brains are
wired
to keep that.
In.
Yes. We want to stay within, because that's where we get fed. That's where we get pleasure. That's where we get, you know, all of the things. So we will uphold these systems. So LL, I want to pivot us a little bit as far as like, that's so much of your own healing journey. And if you want to give us more, that's great. But I would also love to hear about like, what was it like to share your story? What was it like to go public with your books? What's it like to go public in your daily life? Like, how do you hold having a very public story?
Well, the first one, it was scary in the sense that I was a little bit worried because my ex had been the editor of a paper and, you know, I had written essays where I sort of concealed his identity, but people had made some guesses and I didn't want to make it, it was, to me, it was not a story about him. He's got his own story to tell. He can do whatever he wants. And people often also criticize me saying that, oh, the husband character was too much of a cipher. I shouldn't say often. I mean, probably one person said that once and it's stuck in my brain. Do you know?
That's the only voice you hear. Yes.
Right. Right.
But I mean, I think one of the reasons I remember at the time, I took it as a real compliment because I was like, I want him. He is not the main character. He is not even a main character, even though he sort of sets off the inciting incident, as it were. And in that book, it's told from getting to Cutter to boom, there's the divorce. And then what happens after that? So there's definitely, he's sort of part of a longer part of the story, but most of that front piece is just discovering how weird it was. Like, I remember when I discovered it was illegal to date there because we had put out a handbook for incoming teachers and I didn't write it. I didn't even oversee it, really. It's weird. Universities are so siloed, even though I was the marketing communications director, but this was an HR thing. And there was a big crisis because the HR people had included something about dating. And it was, and I remember when Mohammed, who was our COO, came into my office and he was like, this is bad.
Oh my goodness.
So oh, no. All the books had to be recalled or whatever. But then the good news was that I got to have oversight. But I mean, there were just so many interesting, unusual aspects of life there that I found fascinating. I cut probably 500-600 pages out of that book of things that I found interesting that weren't moving the story forward.
Yeah.
Which I kind of discovered through storytelling. I mean, I wasn't a memoirist, as I said, and I'm saying that as if it's somehow derisive toward memoir. It's not at all. I mean that like hard memoir, so hard.
Yes.
And I started telling stories on stage at the Moth in New York City. I kind of decided either I can go to grad school or moved to New York City with that money. Like, I'm going to do one or the other. So I moved to New York and I started storytelling. I was taking classes for craft, but I realized it wasn't fast enough because this stuff was pouring out of me.
Yeah.
You get up on stage, you start telling a story about, let's say, money. That was actually the very first topic at the very first storytelling show that I went to. And I'll never forget. I thought, oh, I have the perfect story because the Persian Gulf, one of the richest areas in the world and Qatar, one of the countries at the time. And I start going on and on about like the oil and gas industry and all this stuff. And the audience is like,
dying, either asleep.
They're dying. Right. And at the end of my story, the lady who was doing the thing, she was like, well, you have a very pretty shirt.
Oh my gosh. You're like, well,
I was like, ouch. I hope I improved. But the point being just that it certainly improved my book. Right. I was like, well, none of that's going to go in the book.
Yeah. And you mentioned that also as far as your experience with Moth and your experience of just throwing yourself into storytelling on stage, which is incredible. And I feel like that's one of those things that people would be like, you're so brave. And you kind of look around and you're like, what other option was there, right? Like, do you feel that way? Or do you feel like it was like courageous?
I think being poor has made me very brave. Because what choice do you have? Like, one of the reasons that I went to so many alternative healing spaces is because they were more affordable than conventional healing spaces. I could go to a meditation circle for free.
Yes.
You cannot go to a therapist for free. Well, you can probably find therapists for free, but I had had experience with free therapists before and it wasn't good. So I didn't feel that that was going to really do anything. You can even find community yoga classes, meditation-based yoga classes. Like, it's so much more accessible to many of us. And now, on this side of the pandemic, the availability isn't even there. You want to go see your doctor? Good luck. I hope you made that appointment 6 months ago. You want to go and join a yoga class? I mean, half the time, I've now got memberships. I mean, I still teach yoga, but I like to take yoga. I have memberships to like 5 different studios because I can never get in any of the studios, which is a different problem. But
you just like to keep them on their toes. You like to play them against each other.
And you can find these like influencers, like these wellness advocates. They're available 24/7, ready to like tell you what's wrong with you and how to fix it. And, you know, we should all keep that skeptic's hat on.
Yes. And I know this is something that you're interested in. This is something that you're publishing some essays around, at least in regards to specific individuals that are leading kind of some of these cultic, like these culty kind of belief spaces or like influencing spaces. It's just fascinating kind of this movement that we're going through as a collective in this culture around, I mean, selling kind of IP and coaching and all of it, whatever that looks like. Something I wanted to reflect on, this is going way back, but I mean, I'm just thinking of what a healing and transformative, I think is a better word, for learning to tell your story on stage and thinking of you coming off of stage and that woman being like, well, your shirt's really pretty. Like, and you being like, fuck, like that was a flop. Like, what does this look like? And for you to open yourself up to going public in that way is extraordinarily transformational. All of the things that you have to navigate. Am I showing up here to be approved in me and myself and who I am and how I am? Or am I here to get some data on storytelling, you know, like, and sussing out all of those different things. And then also not having your stories, you know, like, this is the same thing as what I just said, but not having your stories reflect who and how you are, your identity, like some of those pieces. So there's like a lot of healing stuff wrapped up in getting on stage and telling your story versus having it as a book going out into the world, which I'm sure feels like different.
And they are
going
very
public
different
processes. Yeah.
Because you put your story out on stage and that's it. It's sort of a one-time event, unless you're at one of those events where they're recording or doing things like that. And I've done shows like that as well many times at this point. But, you know, a book feels more permanent because that thing can show up anywhere at any time. And it still is nerve-wracking. I often think, like, gosh, did I say anything really stupid in that book? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact is I do see them as snapshots in time. You know, for instance, audiobook technology has come so far. I've been asked, like, oh, are you going to do an audiobook of your first memoir? And I'm sort of, because I could just do it myself, really. And I'm like, no. You know what I mean? Because I feel like it would be a different book if I was going to write it now and to reread it as if it was sort of fresh. Just, I can't quite imagine it. And I feel like, you know, this book, it'll be interesting to see how it ages.
Mm-hmm. I'm always amazed by, like, I don't know how you'll feel about this, but I'm always amazed by musicians who get on stage and play these songs from decades ago, right? Like, don't you feel like that would be absolute torture? Like, yes. Or they just like dissociate to some level as far as like, this is old content, but like people really want to hear it. I'm like, I'm so glad that I work in media that I'm not having, like, people can still consume it from years and years and years ago and they can place their own meaning on it, whatever, but I'm not having to get up and perform all of my own like old content in front of folks. And it's the first podcast that I was on as one of the hosts, we called it I Contain Multitudes because I required that freedom. I was so afraid of having something archived. And because of that religiosity from my past, I was not given the permission to change my mind. So whatever I presented in public had to be set in stone and had to be like what it was going to be forever. And so I feel like the creative process, though, and being a creative and being an artist really, really reels against that as far as like, we are constantly, and what I learned from spiritual journey models and all of that, we are constantly in a process of becoming and transforming. And we can't, you know, they're not these monoliths of who and how we are. They are a moment in time. I love that so much. It's a documentation of a moment in time of who and how you were at that period.
Right. And so I do think it's weird to hold people like accountable for something that they said 20 years ago. Now, if it's a pattern of behavior that has persisted, then that's a totally different thing.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that clarification. So as we're moving towards the end of our time together today, I do want to know what do you want to create in the world now? What's piquing your interest right now? What are you moving towards?
I am working on novels. So I still want to use writing as a way, whether it's screenwriting or book writing, as a way to tell stories and broadcast stories about issues. I just find it easier to do with fiction.
I love it. I love it. So
that's kind of what I'm doing. But I do have, if people are interested in meditation, I actually put together a quiz for this book. You can go to my website, llkirchner, that's KIRCHNER.com/quiz. And you can take this quiz to see what might be your optimal meditation style. And I'm using air quotes, which, you know, you can't hear. But the point is to sort of show you an array of different styles of meditation. You get a description of the meditation, what the practice is like, what the history is like. And then at the bottom, it's like, here are all the other ones. If you don't like that, check out one of these, to just sort of make it feel more accessible. Yes. But I also did a free storytelling course, a 5-day challenge that you can get. And I will have to send you that URL because it's just completely slipped my mind.
I love it. We'll link it up. And LL2, I'm so glad you're doing that. And I wanted to say this earlier too, but maybe it's just to drill the point home, but I feel responsible for it because it is so important that people find a methodology that is in alignment with who and how they are, whether that's their brain, how their brain works, or their own trauma. Like, it's just so significant because it can have really powerful, powerful impacts for the positive or the negative, right? Or we can make all these narratives around something not working for us, like you did. And we've talked about before, but I saw something the other day, and I'll try to link this up in the show notes if I can find it again. A woman on TikTok that traces a lot of like spirituality and religiosity stuff in our culture now. She's kind of a sociologist, I believe, and psychologist, but talking about her noticing in her own personal experience with getting really into the headless meditation. So getting away from the ego. Mm-hmm. And that for her, her as a woman, and she was getting into it right after she had two kids. She had hardly any person identity beyond serving everyone else at every moment. She had, you know, so her finding is that she had no ego. And so actually trying to pursue this like headless meditation and getting away from the ego was actually really damaging for her. Yes, in her particular life experience in a patriarchal society that she's in also. So just to like really drill home, y'all go check out that quiz because it's so important that you find a methodology that's in alignment with you so that you're not working against yourself in your healing journey.
I'm not compiling that data. Somebody made a comment like, boy, you're asking a lot of really personal questions. What are you doing with this information? And I was like, nothing.
Selling it. No, you're not doing anything.
No, absolutely not selling it. I'm doing nothing with it. I'm not that clever.
It is for you. It is for you.
It is just for you.
Beautiful clarification. So will you give us again where people can follow along on your journey? Are you on Instagram? Are you on social media?
And then I am on Instagram at @LLKirshner_ and the same on X, I guess is what we're calling it now.
I'm not really there very much.
I mostly use it and look and I'm like, oh, I gotta get away. So I got up on Threads, which I guess is the same as your Instagram, but that seems like a weird space too. you can find me at Facebook and all that's linked. If you get one of my books, I don't even know if I talked very much about the new book.
And it's on Kindle Unlimited also. If I have any other
that's
friends
right.
on the Unlimited space.
It's free on Kindle Unlimited, or you can, the audiobook version of that should be coming out any minute now.
Amazing. Yes. And congratulations on releasing another book into the world and all of the other things that you do every single day that aren't your books that are a part of your creative ecosystem, because we all wear so many hats to one, pay the bills and also to fulfill all of our wild and wonderful creative desires, right?
That's right. In fact, I'm going to send you a link to this article that I'm writing on my Substack about it. Right now it's tentatively titled Getting Ground Beneath My Feet, but I don't know if I'm going to keep it at that. And it's about yoga and how that practice can be on and off the mat, sort of,
beautiful.
A better way of putting it. But the whole point of that newsletter, which is another way to connect with me, is to just keep inspiration going for living a creative life. Ooh. Whether this is a writer, an actor, a filmmaker, a poet, whatever. Because I think that the hardest thing to do is to maintain that inner light, because the world is out there ready to snuff it out in a heartbeat. And that's why I'm so cautious. And I like the idea of being a wanderer as opposed to a skeptic.
Yeah.
Because that's very, it's got that inquiring attitude, but that is what we have to do. We remain curious as we go through instead of creating more and more judgments, which is so easy to fall into.
Oh my goodness. Absolutely. Thank you. It pushes in from all directions too. Like, oh, have it all figured out. Have your one thing. Pick your one
thing.
Crush
it.
Yes. And then I don't mean to like bring up whole things when we're at the very end either, but you know me. But also what you were saying as far as when you find one thing and you're like, it's the one thing and now I need to tell everyone about it and like everyone needs to practice this. Something we've been processing a lot in our house is part of getting away from evangelicalism is getting away from being at evangelical also. So that belief that one thing is going to work for everyone. So like my husband will get into something and he'll get really excited and be like, you need to do this. And then he'll reset and be like, oh, this has been really amazing for me. Right.
Right.
So anyhow,
which is really hard because you do want to share your experiences with people that you love. And for some of them, it is going to work. And I think enthusiasm is a beautiful thing as well.
Yes.
It's the expectation that somebody is going to catch that enthusiasm. Yes. Problematic.
Or the judgment that comes, like you were saying, like the judgment that can come for like people not engaging things in a certain way that you think would be powerful for them or something, right? LL, I am so thankful for you. I'm so thankful for your books and what you've put out into the world, how you shared your story. I'm thankful for what you shared with us today and how it will influence all of us creatives that are listening to hear another creative out in the world doing all kinds of wonderful things and putting all of your creative energy out there, as well as maintaining your own recovery and healing and all of the things too. So thanks for being open, honest, willing. I just really appreciate you. Thanks for being here.
I appreciate you too, Karen. Thank you so much.
Hey, creator. I'm glad you're here. Healing through creating and going public with our wild and wonderful creations is challenging, but I'm here for you and I'm totally with you. In a sense, I am. Head over to the website at karenhinmer.com or the show notes to get on the email list. By being on my email list, you receive more from me all about healing through creating and connecting through going public. And you get to follow along and allow me to be your creative guide on how I heal and go public as a creator. Join me. Head to karenhubner.com. That's karinhubner.com or head to the show notes to get on that email list. Thanks for listening. And don't forget, hit that rate and review button while you're here. I would love your feedback. And it helps other people find the show so that they can feel like they have a creative guide on this healing and go public journey. Thanks for being here. Bye.